You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Derek and Danny.
How you doing, Bob?
Hi, Bob.
Couldn't be better in response to Danny's question. And Derek, I'm sure you were curious about my welfare as well.
I am. I'm always curious about your welfare. I think it's funny that we're pretending for the viewers that we just all just logged on and said hi. We've been talking for a few minutes now, but
look, yeah. Notwithstanding that, this is one of the least fake podcasts in the podcast universe. Okay, there is that one bit Definitely. Of artifice where we pretend we've never met each other, but
I like what they do at Always at War with Quincy. They begin each episode with a phone call, like the phone rings. I like that. That's a good one.
Oh,
I thought that was a good bit. nice to hear from you.
So this is our once every 2 months gathering. By us, I mean the Non-Zero Podcast / newsletter, which is my enterprise, and the American Prestige Podcast, which is your enterprise. Derek also has the Foreign Exchanges Enterprise, which I recommend.
Bob, before,
we're all very enterprising.
Before we continue, I want to plug something. We've got a series on the Crusades called Welcome to the Crusades that you could find at welcometothecrusades.com, which we hope would be of interest to non-zero listeners. We did it with people who are medievalists who specialize in this period from the We're Not So Different podcast. So if people are interested in like quite a long series on the Crusades, well over 10 hours of content, check out welcometothecrusades.com. All right, done.
I have to say, I have sensed among our audience a lot of pent-up demand for Crusades-related
Crusades content.
So I think you're going to see a rush of interest and enthusiasm in your direction. Congratulations on that. Must have taken a lot of marketing money to kind of feel that part of America's pulse and realize
it's actually done really well. I think people are hungry for escapist content, and so it's done like we're quite happy. People seem to actually really like it, and it's done really well, which means we're probably going to do more. I don't know, Bob, if you know, there's been several Crusades. This was just on the first Crusade.
There was the second, the third, the fourth Crusade.
So there's plenty of Crusades to do. There's a Crusade in Europe.
Like how Bob jumps immediately to the most tragic of the Crusades.
No, actually, just the only one whose name I could remember.
The other ones are pretty easy. It's 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, so a lot has happened since we last spoke 2 months ago, but just to focus on this week for a second, it seems to be Gaza Awareness Week. Something happened this week. Some threshold of some kind seems to have been reached, and various elites signaled their awareness that there's something going on in Gaza.
Even
Barry Weiss's Free Press ran a piece saying, I think you mean CBS News. Starvation.
Yes, CBS News.
We will get into that. So, yeah, CBS News, owned by Paramount, which either already is or will be owned by Larry Ellison's son. And hey, all of his hard work paid off, you know? It's not easy being born to a billionaire, but he did it. He got it done.
That's right.
And now he can afford to buy media empire.
Respect.
And hats off to him. That's what America is all about. But I want to get back to that particular thing because it drives me completely nuts. So anyway, even the Free Press is on board with saying there's something of concern happening in Gaza. Marjorie Taylor Greene became the first Republican in Congress to call this a genocide. There was a vote on withholding arms to Israel in which probably for the first time, a majority of Democratic senators voted to withhold arms from Israel, even though, of course, the thing didn't pass. And, you know, just various people who, though not ardently pro-Israel, aren't noted for spending a lot of time criticizing Israel, like Ross Douthat, Matt Iglesias, wrote things that, you know, in various ways said, you know, this is, we really should focus on where we are. I don't know. Is this
if only someone had known this would have happened. If only someone had predicted this.
Well, I think we're into, and it's like everything. I mean, we this is echoes of something that happened in the past, but faster, sped up. It's echoes of the cycle that we went through with Iraq, where we finally got to the point where all the sort of centrist folks
who supported that war.
Yeah, same people. Decided that, oh gosh, it turns out this was a bad idea, but I still can't acknowledge that the people who said it was a bad idea at the beginning were right, because that's anathema to me. So I will come up with some convoluted reason why I was actually right to support it in the first place, but I probably should have been a little more aware that it could go sideways. I think that's the same thing you're seeing in a lot of these things. It's you know, like, we were right to support Israel's right to defend itself, but we probably should have understood that, yeah, things could get a little excessive and, you know, some mistakes could be made. And you know, in hindsight, I guess our hearts were in the right place, but we didn't really see all the possible complications. It's ass covering time. I mean, I think you can't starve people to death. And, you know, I love also the implication that like, there wasn't a famine happening in Gaza 6 months ago, but there is one now, as though the famine virus just suddenly descended on Gaza out of nowhere and infected everybody, as though this isn't something that's been building up since the very beginning of this. And certainly since March, when the Israelis cut off all aid into the territory altogether. That this has just happened all of a sudden. And so it was wrong to say there was a famine, you know, back in March, but it's right to say it now. And it's okay for us to say it. It's all just, you know, contortionist bullshit, because people are confronted with the reality of children starving to death, adults starving to death. And, you know, they have to respond to that, but they don't want to give any ground. So they go through these exercises.
And it's not going to affect anything. I mean, I don't think Matt Iglesias is going to lose any subscribers. So it just all feels so pointless. It just, like, banging your head against the wall again and again and again and again and again. It's kind of nihilistic.
You know, Barry Weiss is going to walk away with $250 million. So, yeah, it's not affecting anything. There were no consequences. I think it's only $200 million.
Yeah. I think it's only $200 million.
$200 million was the initial offer. I heard they were.
Oh, she's holding out for
possibly,
more.
She might be holding out for more.
Hey, Non-Zero is available for less than that. I'm gonna text whatever Larry Ellison's son's first name is.
David, I think, isn't it David?
Is it David?
I don't know. I think it's a D.
Yeah. So, let's see. First of all, that's a good question. Has anything enduringly changed? By the way, to Matt's credit, Matt actually has saying...
Let's not disagree.
Matt Iglesias actually, I think for many years, has been saying it doesn't make sense for the U.S. to be giving Israel arms.
What a brave soul.
Hey, not many people were saying it.
He's not saying it for any moral reason, right? He's saying it because Israel is a wealthy country that can buy its own weapons.
Yeah, but also
and develop
some
them.
Stupid political triangulation reason.
Yeah, that's all it is. Right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, man, I hope when I get to the pearly gates and I'm being judged, you two guys aren't there, like, going over my record. Okay, Matt aside. Let me read you a headline from today's New York Times. Anger over starvation in Gaza leaves Israel increasingly isolated. Now, I think that's what a certain amount of this is. Like, especially like in the Free Press, this is people realizing something I've been saying for, I don't know, a couple decades, is like, these policies of Israel's I object to, I don't think are even good for Israel itself in the long run. I think, you know...
Well, it depends what Israel wants, Bob. I mean, like, this is where you're from a liberal humanist perspective, you're correct. But from, I think, what the geostrategy of the right wing that controls Israel is that this is precisely what they want. They want the occupation. They want greater Israel. So this is what they want. And what they think, and it's probably not incorrect, tragically, is that in 15 years, they can do the land acknowledgement from the Trump Hotel in Gaza City and no one's going to care. So I think you have to also put it in that perspective. That this is very clearly what they want, and they have reason to think that in 15, 20 years, no one's going to really care.
I think that certainly is the feeling on the Israeli right. But I think there are a number of people in America who I would call on the right and pro-Israel who think that this has become counterproductive from the point of view of Israel's actual long-term interests.
Vis-a-vis America, vis-a-vis the U.S., basically, right? I think they're worried about the coalition that has supported Israel since basically the 1980s coming apart. I think they probably have a right to be concerned about that. I think that seems to be the case, at least when it comes to the Democratic Party. But the problem with the Democratic Party, though, is that it's so sclerotic, it's difficult to know where it's going to go. I don't know if you saw it, but your listeners, if they haven't, they should check it out. Crystal Ball. And I forget her co-host's name, a Breaking Points interview of Alyssa Slotkin. It was pretty interesting. Did you see that, Bob?
I saw that segment. Yeah.
Yeah, it was because Slotkin didn't like quite know what to do because we're in a transitional moment. So that it's difficult to see where it's going to go, but there's something she didn't know how to respond to, like, a lot of those questions because she couldn't triangulate in her mind because there was no North Star, whereas previously it would have been just Israel has a right to defend itself and a friend in with our partner Israel. And things are obviously changing, though I do think it's difficult to know where it's going to go because it's not an issue, I think, of particular salience, except when there's something mega extreme happening, like a famine.
Yeah. By the way, just to keep people tuned in, I'm going to eventually get around to casting some blame for all this on you two.
on us and too, or on YouTube?
No, you too. Plus YouTube. But you, TWO. Actually, the part of the left you represent, I think, has not been speaking about this in exactly the way I would recommend. But first, let me say why. What, to the extent that Israel should be worried, I want to be precise about what I think the reason is. Here's what I think the reason actually isn't exactly. So there's this quote in this New York Times piece where Nathan Sachs, an analyst of Israeli politics, says, "The usual Israeli view is that this crisis is another temporary problem." But that's a misreading of the world because it's accelerating a global turn against Israel that has dramatic effects, especially among young people. I think there is some of that, people reevaluating their view of Israel. I think the bigger problem for Israel, especially with regards to America, is the, I think, considerable number of elites who have long had misgivings about Israeli policy and about Israel's influence on American policy and have been afraid to speak out. I mean, I've had these experiences where you're having coffee with some upstanding member of the foreign policy establishment and you say something and they kind of like, roll their eyes like, this is Israel doing this again, blah, blah, blah. And you kind of don't pursue it, but you can tell, like, you can already see that they have not been fully forthcoming in public about their beliefs because they fear the repercussions of the speech police coming out and the Anti-Defamation League saying you're anti-Semitic for calling attention to either, Israel's misconduct or the conduct of the Israel lobby or whatever. I think, and I think what you've seen, not just this week, I think it's kind of crested this week maybe, but, over the last year, is what is acceptable to say about Israel, even for upstanding members of the establishment, has changed. And I don't think we're going back to the old world. There will be a backlash and an attempt to reinstall the old rules of speech. But I think that's Israel's bigger problem, is that there have been a lot of people who were unhappy with the situation with Israel. Many of them are influential, and they are discovering that right now they can say at least some things they didn't used to feel they could say, and they're not paying a big price. I think that's Israel's problem.
Yeah. I think, sorry, Derek, please.
Well, I think...
Way to cut off the Jew, Derek.
Couple of things. Yeah. I want you to, you should be the final voice on this. That's why I want to get my Gentile.
You're listening and you're hearing me. Thank you.
Exactly.
I do think it's important to have somebody who always points out when anything is shading toward anti-Semitism in the Israeli, debate over Israel, and that's why we brought Danny.
That's why I'm here.
That's why Danny's here.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things. I think there's a younger generation that, for which the constant drumbeat that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic, and the pattern is always like, of course you can criticize Israel, but not the way you're doing it. And whatever you're doing, it doesn't matter. Whatever you're doing is anti-Semitic. But in theory, you can criticize Israel. That's always the argument. And I think for the younger generation, that argument and the accusation of anti-Semitism just rings hollow at this point. Like, they don't care. They don't buy it. They're not responding to it. They're not cowed by it in the way that previous generations have been. And I think, and you know, Danny may want to jump in on this, but I think that's to the detriment of actually dealing with real anti-Semitism. Like, you've become so desensitized to it because it's been thrown around in such bullshit ways to defend Israel that could be a real problem moving forward. But the second thing I would say, Bob, is that this has been coming for a while, and elites have known it's been coming. They've known that Israel just doesn't have the same purchase for young people, that there's more sympathy toward the Palestinians. There's more awareness of what the Israeli government has done to the Palestinians. And that's why you see this very draconian, very intense effort to take what had been the unwritten rules and write them out and institute them in universities, in government, even, you know, in terms of like what you're allowed to say or how you're allowed to act if you want to do business with the government. Like, you know, in Texas, you've got this, you got to sign a loyalty oath to Israel, basically, if you want to do any business with the government. Like, it's absurd levels of this stuff. But I think that's the reaction to what they see has been happening for a while now.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of different ways. Just to pick up on the last thing Derek said before I go a little earlier in what he said, you could always tell that hegemony in sort of the Gramscian sense, you know, the sort of like soft things that people are forced to believe is weakening when you get things like loyalty oaths, because that means the common sense assumption that you're going to abide by these norms isn't being followed and it has to be enforced. It's like when you're studying the ancient world, whenever there's a law against something, you know that people were doing that. And so I think this is actually a sign of weakness more than anything else. I think a lot of things are happening. I think as the Holocaust recedes further and further into history, and particularly as the 1973 Arab-Israeli War also recedes further into history, this is the Holocaust, a moment of Jewish existential peril, and the 73 war being perceived as a moment when Israel, you know, almost quote-unquote lost. As those recede further into memory, I think a lot of the sort of ideological coalitions that responded into that have become weakened because it's not in living memory any longer. So people are more willing to, in the wake of this, you know, world historic tragedy against the Jewish people, in which an incredible number of Jews were just annihilated, they're willing to criticize Israel in a way that they weren't, because that's not a living memory. It's not as felt in the same way.
Yeah.
Also, I think particularly in the United States, Jews have become what, you know, academics call, and it's an imprecise term, they have become more and more quote unquote white over the second half of the 20th century and over the first part of the 21st century. There was a moment in American history where Jews were really oppressed, when they were not welcome into the Anglo-German elite, or even, you know, frankly, the German Jewish elite that had come here before the Eastern European elite. That has just changed over the course, for a variety of complex reasons, over the course of the last 75 plus years. So Jews are viewed in a different way. This is not to say that anti-Semitism doesn't exist. Whenever I look at the statistics, it does seem like stochastic attacks against Jewish institutions are still rather prevalent. They do actually occur, but this type of structural anti-Semitism that had defined American life no longer exists. So as that goes away, you're going to have a different relationship to Israel. The question, though, is that what happens in 10 or 15 or 20 years when this goes away? Is this going to be a permanent shift in how Americans relate to Israel, or not? And it's difficult to know, because you do have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson, who in 15, 20 years ago wouldn't have criticized Israel to the same degree, really going hard. I mean, Tucker Carlson is really going hard against Israel, as is Marjorie Taylor Greene. Does that signal something lasting? I'm not sure. It does seem to me, though, that the Democratic Party, the younger base, is shifting decidedly against Israeli geostrategy. But again, I don't know if this is going to be a lasting coalition. Particularly, I'm not sure it's going to actually affect what's going on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, time will tell. And I certainly agree, maybe this isn't exactly what you're saying, that people tend to overestimate the political significance of what has happened so far. I think the classic case was during the presidential election, when people would look at these public opinion polls, what Democrats were saying about Gaza, and saying, God, is Kamala Harris not paying attention? I mean, what's wrong? Does she not read the politics here? And they just did not understand that this goes well beyond, I mean, in terms of the influence of Israel and kind of, I would say, right-wing pro-Israel voices in America on American politics, it goes beyond sheer vote counting, okay? There's a lot of money behind, what I would call a kind of reactionary, but certainly right-wing views on Israel. And they manifest in a lot of ways. Donations, for sure. I'm sure Kamala was attentive to that. But I think there are lots of other ways that the influence is carried in think tanks and various other ways that, you know, just the whole pro-Israel speech police. So I agree with all that. At the same time, I don't think we're ever going back entirely. And I'll tell you, and this gets at my kind of criticism of parts of the left. I think one thing that needs to be done is we need to talk more candidly about the forms of pro-Israel influence, right? The so-called Israel lobby, broadly speaking. And this is where I think the left has been reluctant in many ways, partly for ideological reasons, and maybe largely. And by that, I mean the kind of left-wing narrative for why America's Middle East policy seems to be so belligerently pro-Israel. Like, why do we keep supplying the weapons with which they are killing kids in Gaza? They are staging these flagrantly illegal attacks on near... illegal in international law, attacks on nearby countries like Syria, like Iran. And why do we join them in like bombing Iran? And I think the left is inclined to say, well, this is what empires do, or it's about oil, or blah, blah, blah. I just think that's wrong. It's not mainly about those things. It's mainly about fear of the domestic political consequences of not doing what Bibi Netanyahu says he wants us to do. I think that is the main reason, certainly a very substantial reason that America's policy in the Middle East has been so misguided. And again, I don't think it's even been good for Israel. And I think we're starting to see that. But
Bob, it's both, right? I mean, like, it's
yeah,
both. Like,
well, yeah, you but can't I'm just saying, with... you, I'm yeah. just saying, and I've noticed this in our conversations, you guys don't talk much about one of the two. You really don't. You really don't. And I don't think it's just, I think there is a natural, look, let me say there's a legitimate concern here, which I think is misguided, but I think there's two other factors. There's just fear that you will be labeled anti-Semitic because, you know, criticizing Israel, criticizing the Israel lobby are two different things, right? Criticizing the Israel lobby can more readily be called an anti-Semitic trope because there are these anti-Semitic tropes about Jews controlling the world and controlling this and controlling that. So there is fear of being tarred with that by the pro-Israel speech police. And then there's what I would call a more legitimate concern that you actually are aiding and abetting anti-Semitism. Because there are certainly people in the dark recesses of the internet who are flat out anti-Semites who will nod their heads vigorously if they hear you saying what I'm saying, you should say a little more. But I personally believe, and I've talked to some of my Jewish friends about this, and certainly some of them agree, that what most foments the intensification of that dark anti-Semitism, or one thing that does foment it, is their feeling that nobody's talking about this. That's part of the conspiracy. Nobody's talking about this. And I do think that in some cases sunlight is the best disinfectant. And in this case, the benign effects of the disinfectant would be not just getting us to reevaluate our policy, but getting some of these people to quit acting as if they're the only ones talking about this. That's pretty much my whole spiel on the subject.
I don't think this is absent from, I don't think this is absent from the way the left talks about U.S. support for Israel. I would say, I mean, this is limited to social media. I don't cover domestic politics. I don't get into campaign stuff. I try to actively avoid it as much as possible, actually. But I see this, anytime, there's criticism of the way that the Harris campaign handled this, the way that John Fetterman talks about Israel-Palestine and, basically wishes death on Palestinian children, every other day. There's always, I always see somebody, mentioning how much money these people are getting from the Israel lobby and connected donors. So I don't think it's absent. You may be right. It's not talked about as much, but I think that's partly a backlash against the kind of rhetoric. And this is not you, and I'm not saying that talking about the Israel lobby necessarily leads to this, but I do think there is a tendency that people on the left push back against to deny agency to the United States government. You get these stories about the U.S. is being pulled into war by Netanyahu, or it's being, it's lurching, stumbling around the world, kind of doing, dumb things and stumbling into conflict or stumbling into this or being, yanked into that. And it absolves on some level the empire from doing, from responsibility for doing the things that it's doing. So I think that to the extent that people downplay the effect of the Israel lobby, it may be because they feel like that's, getting, it's taking away agency from the decisions that the U.S. and its leaders are making.
Bob, I'd also have to know, specifically who you're talking about, because it is definitely something that, if you read Jacobin, it is talked about. If you read any of the major left-wing magazines,
there
it's
are
talked
people
about.
On the left, although even there, I would say, I think there's a tendency to focus on, political donations per se, the Israel lobby as APAC. And it's more than that. It's the way, most Americans hear the Anti-Defamation League. It's funny. I heard on a tech podcast, two people, and they're not particularly political. God knows they're not deeply lefty or blah, 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 blah. But they were talking about the ADL in some other context, not really this. And both slipped and said JDL instead of ADL. Of course, the Jewish Defense League is this radical. Are they still around even? Anyway, they were crazy. But that kind of slip suggested to me that more people realize than are saying that the Anti-Defamation League is most significantly part of the Israel lobby. I'm sorry. I mean, you look at their record, what they do and don't condemn. They did condemn the building of a mosque in New York, near the World Trade Center.
The Ground
Center.
Zero Mosque, which wasn't the that Ground close Zero to Ground Mosque. Zero, if I recall correctly.
And I have personally been on the receiving end of attacks by the head of the ADL for saying things that had nothing to do with
Jews
or any other
Bob, I'll protect you, don't worry. We're here to protect you. We're here to
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I don't care. I don't care. I'm just saying, there needs to be more awareness in America that organization should have no credibility unless they want to just come out in the open and say, look, we're here to defend Bibi Netanyahu's policies and to try to stigmatize people who might erode support for those policies in America. That's our main mission, and that is their main mission. And
You can't even get people to agree that APAC should register as a foreign lobby, which obviously is. It's advocating on behalf of a foreign country.
That's what Tucker Carlson asked someone recently.
It's hard. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I'm not to step on Danny. Like, just to respond to one thing in there, the tendency to focus on campaign contributions. I think part of that stems from the fact that those are readily available, and a lot of this other stuff is opaque, like what the ADL is doing, who's funding the ADL. The think tank space is a huge thing. I mean, you've got think tanks openly, in D.C. that advocate for Israel above all else. But, getting into the nuts and bolts of that, like who's funding them, a lot of them don't release their funders, or if they do, they release them in very opaque ways. Like, here's everybody who's given us over, $5 this year, and it's just a list, an undifferentiated list. Like, it's harder to dig into that stuff, and so it's easier, I think, to focus on the donations. But you're right. I mean, it obviously goes much deeper than that.
But go ahead.
Just a couple of quick things. People should check out the Think Tank Funding Tracker at thinktankfundingtracker.org. Yeah. Which really actually traces these things done by the Quincy Institute. And Bob, not to cut you off, just very quickly. I think another issue is that just the left analytical worldview takes the existence of the imperial structure as prime. And so the problem, it's not a matter of if there were better, smarter lobbyists, or if there were better, smarter people, we would have a better imperial foreign policy. So I think in a rhetorical or discursive environment where no one criticizes the empire as such, the empire qua empire, that is what the left, and I think importantly, focuses on, because there is zero voice that actually criticizes the geostrategy of the United States to have 750 bases, $1 trillion defense budget, et cetera, et cetera. And so if that sort of criticism starts re-entering American politics, I think the left would also shift its discursive focus. And I also just don't think it's true that the left doesn't talk about it, even though I agree it is not the prime.
No, I'm not saying
criticism.
Nobody on the left does, but I have, and look, there are people on the left I could point to who are completely immune to this criticism. But I do think, I mean, let me give you an example. I think you mentioned think tanks and the funding. Sometimes the funding is opaque. You know, somebody who's done good work on this is, of course, Eli Clifton at the Quincy Institute, just broadly, like the role of arms makers in donating in the various interest groups, various lobbies, not just the Israel lobby, in supporting think tanks. You're right, it is somewhat opaque. But we know enough, for example, to say that the Foundation for Defense of Democracies is an ardently, I would say almost crazily, pro-Israel, right-wing pro-Israel, super hawkish, think tank that has gotten money in the past from the late Sheldon Adelson, may peace be upon him, and this guy Bernard Marcus, the guy I found at Home Depot, super pro-Israel hawk. The New York Times has this shamelessly symbiotic relationship with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where partly because I think the FDD does a good job of like providing data that's useful, including data nobody else has, maybe, but whatever. It's like the New York Times should be called out every time. I mean, look, ideally there would just be transparency such that every time they quote anybody or run an op-ed by anybody at a think tank, you just magically see where the money came from. But I mean, focusing on their reliance on like FDD, or for that matter, more in the context of Ukraine, maybe the Institute for the Study of War, that I think that should become a little more of a hobby horse. Like, give the New York Times shit for quoting these people as if they are like objective analysts or something, without noting that they are paid propagandists.
I mean, this is something that used to get talked about. I remember during the negotiations leading up to the nuclear deal in 2015, was why every time the New York Times writes a story about the Iranian nuclear program is somebody from FDD quoted in the story, or, some figure that FDD has provided. And it was because these places are as much media operations as they are research outfits. Like, they have such a sophisticated way of getting the message out to reporters, and they make it so simple. Like, here's our daily brief, and here's what you need to know. And I don't know. I can't speak to the Institute for the Study of War, but they're in so much of the Ukraine coverage that I have to assume they do it the same way. And if you're a reporter at the New York Times and somebody's just plopping this in your lap every day, it's the easiest thing in the world to just say, yeah, okay, I'm going to quote you. And you're available to get a quote anytime. And it's very simple. And I think, yeah, institutionally, there's a lack of awareness on the left that it's more about the flash than the substance on some level. Like you have to have that level of outreach to reporters to get to get that kind of coverage.
Wait, Bob, we should do the paywall. It's been a while.
Okay, let me I want to quickly say two things. First of all, there should be a restrainer think tank that's better at this kind of thing, that is good at like data analysis. And they go to these reporters and go, isn't this a cool graph? Like, nobody's seen the data presented this way, right? And they're like, yeah, that would get some clicks.
Well, there's like two restrainer think tanks and the 5,000 non. I mean, like, there's Quincy Defense Priorities.
That's why I said we need more. They do different things. They have different strengths. But I don't know that any of them are playing this particular part of the FDD game well. Anyway, the quickly, Derek, on the agency issue. First of all, as for saying BB is dragging us into war, as opposed to this is American empire at work. First of all, you can see again, like BB dragging us into war. That is an anti-Semitic trope. I mean, this is the delicacy of the thing, right? Like Jews dragging us into war is an old anti-Semitic trope. So you really are kind of playing with fire. Now, for reasons I've already articulated, I think if it is the case that Israel or any other country has a lobby, and look, other countries do it, there is a Ukraine lobby, a blah, 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 if there is a lobby that's, and by the way, I just got to do a standard disclaimer now, you know, Russia is the one that violated international law invading Ukraine, period. And I don't want to, whatever. I'm just saying that whenever interest groups are trying to influence your policy, ideally, that would be transparent. In this case, I understand why people genuinely concerned about anti-Semitism are concerned about saying they're trying to drag us into war. But everybody knows Bibi did want to drag us into war with Iran. And in fact, if there's any credit to be given to Trump, it's that he joined him in a way that kind of put a punctuation mark on it, right? And kind of stopped it, at least for the time being. But as for which is more effective, I'm not sure that saying this is empire at work really has a lot of traction rhetorically. I don't know. I mean,
well, none of it matters. Wait, Bob, none of it matters. I mean, like, this is the real issue, right? You're operating under this like Habermasian frame that, like, when we all know the language and the truth that this light will do, it's just nonsense. We're like in a decaying society. No one gives a shit. We all know it's corrupt. I mean, like, some of the things I actually shouldn't, but anyway, but like, that's the problem, right? The problem is that you could have your funded by the Foundation of Defense of Democracy on the thing. It's not going to matter. And that's the real problem of our society. Sorry, I just wanted to interrupt. I think the framing is wrong. This Habermasian notion of once the knowledge is out, we're all going to talk and then we're going to come to a rationalist foreign policy, which is going to be good for the land. It's just not correct. So there's something like fundamentally wrong here. I just wanted to add, and that's another reason I think the left doesn't focus on as much, because I don't think the left correctly thinks it matters that much. Everyone knows it's corrupt.
We should have done the paywall, because normally I use Habermas as the paywall bait. I say, like, if you want to hear Deity tell us who the fuck Habermas.
Little Habermasian discussion coming up.
You know,
the rational analysis.
Also, I generally say, okay, Danny Besser's going to go full on nihilist on us, but you got to pay for that.
And now
we've already heard your nihilistic despair. Nothing will work. Nothing can help. I remain naively hopeful that however small the chances of our making the world a better place, It's
well, liberalism failed. That's what we should talk about, Bob. Like, liberalism failed. What do you do?
Okay, no, this is perfect paywall bait. I attacked you guys, and now you're going to attack me.
Oh, you define yourself as a liberal? How do you define yourself?
That word is used so much. I mean, Jesus, when I was...
Oh, come on.
No, I mean, look, when I was
What is a word?
Which seems like only yesterday, a liberal man... Like neoliberal meant something different from what it means now. And liberal meant something different. And then, of course, in the 19th century, I think in a way the meaning has returned to more like what it was in the 19th. Anyway, this is like Habermas, history of the word liberalism. You got to pay for this shit, folks. So if you're a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero Newsletter or the American Prestige podcast, you get access to what's about to happen. And I mean, it's so fitting that Hulk Hogan died this week, because what's about to happen, folks, is going to make Hulk Hogan look like, you know, a Buddhist monk or something. This is going to be, the fists will be flying. This is going to be amazing. Do you guys want to say anything else before we head into overtime?
Pay up.
Welcome to the crusades.com.
Welcome to the crusades.com. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks to everybody who stuck with us this far. It's going to get wild in overtime, and we're going in overtime.